Hello, I'm Richard Burrell. This is number 0529, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0529. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet John Barber, the creator, producer, co-host, and the writer of the trend-setting NBC hit, Real People. He has written his autobiography entitled, Your Mother's Not a Virgin. John is considered to be the godfather of reality TV.
Real People, when it debuted, was like number 41 in the ratings, which is really low. But it got 8,000 pieces of mail, which was more than the number one show. Nobody understood the show that I had created. I was unemployed when I was 46, and I said, I'm going to change the face of American television with what I call the entertainment of reality. Even though I was out of work when I was 46, when I was 47, I had the number one show in American television.
Tosca Lee is an award-winning, best-selling author of 11 novels, and she has her latest novel out called A Single Light. It's the sequel to her critically acclaimed dystopian thriller, The Line Between. How much of the story do you have to know when you start writing?
There's all different ways that authors do this. There's the pantsers who write by the seat of their pants, and then there's the plotters. I'm kind of in between. I have to plot a certain amount of the story, and I have to kind of know what's happening at the various turning points in the story. And I may not know exactly how it ends. And when I do have a sequel, I don't plot the sequel when I plot the first book. I leave myself hanging and then go into the second book with, oh my gosh, how am I going to write my way out of this one?
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0529, was broadcaster and voiceover announcer Richard Burrell, who is the owner of VoxBox Canada. And you can find out more about VoxBox by going to the website at thestufffile.com. Clicking on the show number for this program, which you just heard Richard say, and you'll find all the information about his amazing business. You know, Richard and I go back a long way. We were co-workers at a radio station many, many years ago, an all-around nice guy. And I thank you very much, Richard, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com. to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff. And this first story, I gotta say, there is just so much to unpack here in this first story. It's about a 37-year-old West Hollywood, California man whose name is Sexy Vegan. His given name at birth was Hansel DiBartolo III, which means that two people who grew up with the name Hansel thought it was perfectly fine to name their offspring that in the 20th century. Anyway, after legally changing his name in 2016, he had the new handle tattooed on his forehead and chest. He's an Instagram sensation with over 1 million followers and a 2020 presidential candidate, according to his IMDb profile. Let's pause there for a moment. I checked his IMDb profile to see what he had going on. First of all, his IMDb bio is way longer than mine, but that's okay. I also am not going to share any of his bio with you on this show because, frankly, it's just way too weird. But his only two credits on IMDb tout a role in a video called The Minx and an appearance as himself on the Dr. Phil show back in 2017. It was an episode entitled My brother changed his name to Sexy Vegan, wears Speedos in public, and is spending my mom's $11 million inheritance. Oh, please, let me share with you just a minute, actually less than a minute, about 55 seconds of his appearance on the Dr. Phil show, where he spewed profanity directed at his mother, who was on the stage, before he was escorted from the set.
I am the beautiful vegan messiah.
Is that water okay?
It's a song. I didn't say I was, and she knows it. I was just like my dad, okay? 10 luxury cars. My dad told me I had the same name as him until I legally changed it. My mom did not bail me out of jail when she knew I was innocent. I'm liberating over 70 billion pigs in cages so small they cannot move for years, okay? I work. My mom's a sociopathic piece of I have the highest score in Hot or Not history. I got 9.9 out of 10 after 327 women rated me. Let's see your talent. Let's see your talent, you ugly piece of
Okay, stop. Hey, look at me.
Let's
look
see
at
your
me.
Talent.
No,
huh?
Hey. No, you need to look at me.
I don't have to do
Okay, take him out. Security, get him out of here.
Thank God.
Yeah. By the way, as he was raging against his mom, he was also moonwalking across the stage for some reason. Okay, so, you get the idea that he is a vegan and he cares about protecting animals, such as in that pig story that he was sharing. But now he's in the news for another reason. Recently, Vegan's been a resident of the Twin Towers Correctional Facility following his arrest on September 26th on charges of, wait for it, sexual abuse of his dog, which authorities say he captured on video and posted on social media. By the way, the dog is a pit bull, not exactly an animal that I want to sneak up behind. Now, as he told Dr. Phil back in 2017, I do get judged a lot for being different. Ooh, you know, normally I try to say something either witty or pithy at the end of each story. No. For this one, I got nothing. I'm just shaking my head. Just shaking my head. So let's move on. Some guy on the internet sent Faye Kinley a message. Hey girl, you are so sexy. He attached a picture of what's between his legs. So she responded with a picture of what's between hers. It's the same kind of thing he has, by the way. But hers is a lot bigger. The Glasgow, Scotland student is transgender and still has the equipment she was born with. What the hell? The man replied. I'm blocking your number now. Delete this conversation. Instead, she shared it on social media, including the photos with the offending members blocked out. I've received a fair few unsolicited pictures in the past, she said, but for some reason it just occurred to me how funny it would be if I did exactly the same thing. His response was exactly as I expected it would be. Okay. I'm appealing to the ladies in the audience here. What kind of man sends such pictures unsolicited? Does the thought of this ever remotely work on you, ladies? Because I'm guessing this isn't the first time that he has sent out a picture of Jim and the twins. So, gals, send me an email. And no pictures, please. Send an email to peter@thestufffile.com with your thoughts on this story. Because I'm just curious. I gotta find out. And by the way, I am mildly amused that the original sender got into a measuring contest with a woman and lost. He's going to have to go out and buy an expensive sports car now. Yikes. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? John Barber is recognized as the godfather of reality TV. That's because he was the creator, producer, co-host, and writer of the trend-setting NBC hit Real People. After a lifetime in television, the multiple Emmy winner has just written his autobiography. It's entitled, Your Mother's Not a Virgin, The Bumpy Life and Times of a Canadian Dropout Who Changed the Face of American TV. John is currently visiting his home country, our home country. He joins us on the line via Skype from Toronto. Hi, John.
Well, thank you so much. It sounded terrific the way you introduced me in the book. Thank you again so much for having me on. I deeply appreciate it.
I appreciate having you on. We had a chance to talk a little bit off air before, and I reminded you of a story that I want to share here on the program, and that is I loved watching Real People. It was on NBC from 1979 to 1984. And I remember a segment where you had a bunch of children, I guess they were part of the Special Olympics, and you had video of them, or film of them, I guess it was, and you were showing them competing, and it was done in slow motion, and the music in the background to the segment was Paul McCartney and Wings with A Little Luck. And I sat there watching this, literally blubbering like an idiot.
Well, it was so moving. I'm glad it had that impact. You know, it was the highest rated television show in history. It always got about, after the first year when it became number one, it got a 50 share. That means that half of all the people in the United States watching television were watching that show. And it was designed primarily as an entertainment show where we would profile and let people explain their unusual lifestyles, like the stripper for God, or the lawyer in New York who is the only professional vampire hunter in America. But I always felt when we had a large audience, if we came across a great story like the one that you were talking about with the Paul McCartney song, I felt it our obligation to tell that story. And so I'll tell you very quickly, Real People played a major role in getting that Vietnam Memorial Wall built in Washington, D.C. Because you might remember it was an extremely unpopular war, and it was designed by an Asian American. So she had two strikes against her for being a woman and an Asian, and nobody wanted it built. I did the story of a professor in New Mexico whose son died 7 days after he landed in Vietnam, and he built a private memorial in the top of a hill where he and his son used to go hunting all the time. And soon, literally hundreds and hundreds of people by osmosis heard about it because it wasn't in the media, and it grew from this small chapel to this massive building. Then we also got President Reagan to come on and give a presidential citation to the Navajo Code Talkers. And you know the name John Walsh?
Yes.
Yes, America's Most Wanted. Well, his son Adam was kidnapped from a mall in Miami. And I hate to tell you this, but when they found him, they found out he'd been beheaded. But before they found his son, John was going all over trying to get the Miami police and everybody in the Florida police departments and the FBI to cooperate to look for missing children, not just his son. And he had no luck because they were so proud of what they were doing on their own, they wouldn't cooperate. I saw John on television. I decided I would tell his story. I told his story, and 60 days later, they passed the Missing Children's Act, and he sent me this glorious letter thanking us for doing that. So you say that I was the godfather of reality TV. For that show, and that show alone, I will take enormous bows for that. I was dubbed that by Gary Deeb, who was the greatest film TV critic in America. He was a syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune, and he said of television in the 70s, television is the only business in America where competition does not improve the product, until he saw my show. But when I was in television, we had three networks, so there was a competition to get good stuff on the air. Here's the paradox now. We got 500 stations. The more stations, the less we have to watch. It's like more straws in the same septic tank. When I got into television, you had to have a modicum of talent, a modicum and a bit of intelligence and a bit of a personality. Today, that would prevent you from getting a job in reality television, because all you need today is an absence of shame and a camera.
And we should also mention one very important point. You, as you described, your show was number one on NBC. We should mention the fact that when you go back to when your show went on the air, NBC was not the strong network that it is now, or when we heard of must-see TV. NBC was the third place network of three networks on TV. It couldn't be any lower at the time. And your show helped to bring a resurgence of what we now know as the glory days of NBC.
Well, it was even worse than that, because you might remember that they had all their broadcasting eggs in the Olympic basket, and the United States and the Soviet Union had a falling out, so there was going to be no Olympics, which was to be carried by NBC. And it's wonderful you mentioned that. My gosh, that's interesting. Because Real People, when it debuted, was like number 41 in the ratings, which is really low. But it got 8,000 pieces of mail, which was more than the number one show. NBC, nobody understood the show that I had created. Because I said, I was unemployed when I was 46, and I told Maury Gelman at the Daily Variety, because I've been going around trying to sell this concept, I said, I'm going to change the face of American television with what I call the entertainment of reality. And even though I was out of work when I was 46, when I was 47, I had the number one show in American television. So I'm so glad you brought that up.
I also alluded in the introduction of you as the godfather of reality TV, and I think you've kind of already answered the question. I look back to the time when that show first went on the air, and it was considered reality TV, and it was so quaint and genteel and high quality at the time. As I said, I think you've already alluded to the question. What we call reality TV today and what you were putting on as reality TV back in 1979 are really two different things.
Oh, my goodness gracious. You know, if you think we have a political swamp in the United States, you must take a look at television, which is a visual swamp. I cannot watch it. It is totally, totally embarrassing. And I said, you know, we have 500 channels. And I'm struggling here in the hotel room to find something to watch. And if I catch a hockey game or a golf match or something, I'll watch that, because it's the only thing in television that is unpredictable.
Do you think in this day and age that something like Real People could be on television again, anew?
No, it will never, ever, ever, ever happen in the United States again. When I was much younger, when I first ran away to the United States I came from a very dysfunctional home in Toronto. I was born in the Salvation Army Hospital, ran away to the United States when I was 17 to be a gambler, and ended up in Hollywood and accidentally became very successful. And I must say this. All these magnificent things that happened to me, getting Real People on the air, becoming Frank Sinatra's private writer, and becoming the Boswell to Jim Garrison, who was played by Kevin Costner in Oliver Stone's JFK. All of these things happened to me by accident, and all the disasters in my life were well planned. But when I was younger and watching television, I could name you 30 or 40 people who were an absolute total inspiration to me. I mean, even somebody like William F. Buckley, who was very conservative, of course, he was funded by the CIA, but he would be on television, and there he would have Gore Vidal on, who was this brilliant, literate, witty liberal, and they would clash, and I would just be enchanted by the verbal foreplay with these guys. I could name you dozens of them, both in Canada. We had Lorne Green on the CBC telling his magnificent stories. They will never be on television again. The same way there will never be another Jim Garrison as a district attorney in the United States of America. You know, America is in dreadful, dreadful, dreadful shape. And I must say, because a lot of people say to me, what do you think America needs, you know? And my comment to that is, you know, America doesn't need a larger army, and America doesn't need that wall across the Mexican-California border, and America doesn't need a final peace treaty between Palestine and Israel. What America needs is a larger rug to sweep all the crap under. It is really, really bad. But I do have hope, because I couldn't live without hope. I can't live with negativity at all. But I have never, ever been wrong when I predicted a presidential election, because as a comic, when you do stand-up, you know, the best thing about Donald Trump, the reason they voted for him, even though all the mainstream media wanted him, he wasn't Hillary Clinton. That was his major asset. That's how he got in. And I have predicted from the time I started doing stand-up who the next president of the United States would be, because if you're doing jokes about both sides and one side gets bigger laughs, you know that side is the loser. Mm. It would have been a slam dunk 3 months ago for Donald Trump to be reelected in 2020. And now I have my doubts, because Netanyahu was running around Israel when he was campaigning, and every place he went, he held up a picture of himself with Trump, and they voted against him. So now it's kind of questionable.
You know, John, we haven't had a chance to talk about your book. We've gone through this entire conversation. I do want to talk about your book. So why don't we take a quick break, and we'll come back on the other side and talk about your book, which is Your Mother's Not a Virgin, and also how we here in Canada lost you. How about that?
Oh, that would be wonderful. Thank you so much.
We're talking with John Barber here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Coming to you from the outskirts of sanity, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And we're talking with the legendary John Barber, who, as I mentioned earlier, recognized as the godfather of reality TV. He was the man who was the creator, producer, co-host, and writer of NBC's hit show Real People back in 1979. And he's also the author of a biography, an autobiography called Your Mother's Not a Virgin, The Bumpy Life and Times of the Canadian Dropout Who Changed the Face of American TV. John, first of all, the title of your book, Your Mother's Not a Virgin, where did that come from?
Oh, what a great, great question. And it leads me to, I actually had two choices about the title. Now, I know your show is not political, but since you're into truth, I'm going to tell you how it came about, because you're so interested in the media. In 1970, I was hosting the first morning news information show on ABC in Los Angeles. And it was a year after Jim Garrison had lost his conspiracy case against Clay Shaw. Did you ever see the movie JFK?
Absolutely. The Oliver Stone movie?
Yes. Well, yes. Kevin Costner played Jim Garrison. Well, I accidentally read Garrison's book called The Heritage of Stone while I was in a bookstore one day, and I learned stuff I never learned from the media. And that is that he had to take Time Life to the Supreme Court to get the Zapruder film. And a forensic pathologist named Fink, who was called as a defense witness for Clay Shaw, admitted there was never an autopsy. And I'm reading all this stuff, so I call Mr. Garrison to book him on the show, and he says, you're not going to get away with it. And I say, Mr. Garrison, I've just won my first Emmy, and I literally have to talk him into it. I say, we're the first one to open the phones so people can call in and ask you questions. I mean, it's the greatest story in the world. And what it is that I am, Peter, I'm a storyteller. I grew up listening to Lorne Greene on CBC. I grew up reading Gordon Sinclair and his and when I was a youngster, it was stories and movies that kept me alive. And now that I'm older, it's the telling of them. In any event, he said to me, when we relaxed, he said, you know, it's 1970, John, and the Harris poll says 83% of all Americans don't believe the Warren Report. So I said, well, if that's the case, sir, why aren't they out there storming the barricades? And he said, well, you didn't see the second question. And I said, what was the second question in the Harris poll? And the second question was, would you like to see a more serious investigation, including one into the FBI and the CIA? And he said only 21% they would. So what does that say about Americans? And Peter, without missing a beat, I said, you know what it says to me, Mr. Garrison? I know what my mother and father did, you know, in the pool table or in the rumble seat of the car, the bed, to conceive me. But don't ever tell me my mother's not a virgin. I mean, it just popped up. Well, he started to laugh and he said, you know, Mark Twain said, it's easier to fool people than to convince people that we have, that you have been fooled, which is true. But in any event, that became the title of the book. But I, the other title of the book is based on a story about Wayne and Schuster. And I loved Wayne and Schuster, and you probably know that was the Canadian comedy team that appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show in the United States more than any other act. Did you know that?
63 times.
63 times. So I'm glad you know that. Anyway, their agent was a guy named Marty Kummer, who later became Jack Parr's manager. And Jack Parr was by the best of all the late night hosts. And he was the inspiration for me to become a comic. Anyway, what happened is that the heads of Universal were looking around and saw there were no more comedy teams in America. I mean, it's like Martin and Lewis were going to break up, and there was nobody else around, and you got these two Canadians. So they call Marty, and they say, listen, we would love to do a pilot for Wayne with Wayne and Schuster, and we'll pay a lot of money. So Marty calls Johnny Wayne and says, you know, we got this offer from Universal. And John says, no, we're very happy up here. We got this great show already on the CBC. We're very, very happy. So tell them no. So Marty tells Universal no, and Universal calls back and said, hey, it's not a pilot. It's 13 weeks, and it's guaranteed. So Marty calls Johnny back again, and Johnny repeats, listen, I told you, we got a series for years up here. We're happy. Our families are happy. So tell them no, thank you. So Universal hears that, calls back with a firm 26-week offer, which is what happened to real people. It was only the first time in television history that we got, after the first pilot, the special we did, Peter, we got a commitment for 26 shows. So anyway, it's turned down again. And then the final call comes from Universal. They say, look it. We want to turn them into motion picture comedy stars. There are no more comedy teams. So aside from, they can have their choice. They can have two or three movies guaranteed or 26 weeks. We'll pay you double what the CBC is paying. So anyway, Marty calls John back again and begs and begs, because here's this huge commission for the William Morris office. And John says, listen, how many times do I have to tell you? Our families love it here. The kids love the schools here. We're going to have a couple of grandchildren here. We want them to grow up in this very happy land. So tell them no. And Marty Kummer screams at him, damn it, Johnny, there's more to life than happiness. So I almost called the book, There's More to Life Than Happiness. But the reason I ended up calling it Your Mother's Not a Virgin, because the truth is, it is a very uncomfortable truth. And there are a lot of uncomfortable truths in the book. But also, you know, I for some reason or other, I have this mechanism that turns the crap that was thrown at me into funny fertilizer. And there's a lot, the book is truly truly funny. You know who Mike Farrell is?
Yes, from MASH and also the television series The Interns.
That's exactly right. Well, Mike called me. Now, I don't know Mike. And Mike called me about 3 months ago on a Sunday. I don't know how he got my number. And he said, John, now his wife, I forget his wife's name. I think it's Shelley. She's also a very successful actress. He said, you know, John, I wanted to wait till I got to the end of your book because my wife and I are having the greatest fun reading to each other segments from your book and laughing and crying, and it is so good, I just had to call you.
And by the way,
I said, thank you. And he said, I'll be calling you back. He called me 3.5 weeks ago. He said, John, we finished the book. It's the best book I have ever read about anybody in show business. I'm sending you a review. I'm going to put it on Goodreads, and I hope it helps you sell books when you go back to Canada.
By the way, his wife is Shelley Fabre, and she's the niece of the late Nanette Fabre.
That's exactly right. I'd forgotten her last name.
Yeah. You mentioned the story about Wayne and Schuster and the fact that they wouldn't go down to the United States. So that begs to ask the question, how did we lose you?
I had no choice. As I said, I came from a very, very dysfunctional family. In 1939, my father joined the Canadian Army to go to the peace and quiet of World War II. He'd rather fight Germans with guns than my mother with a beer bottle. And uncles came into my life like grapes. They came in bunches. And they usually came to booze with my mother or bed with my mother or mostly beat my mother. So I spent most of the time from the time I was 6 on till I left when I was 17 out on the streets. And, you know, you get into when you come from a broken home, Peter, you know, you want to get attention and it's never doing anything decent. It's always doing something terrible. So I got in trouble a lot and arrested a lot and all kinds of problems. But from the time I was like 15 to 17, I became this very compulsive gambler, and everything I could steal or work for, which I did often, I would lose. I was always the first to lose and the last to leave. And then, Peter, I said to myself, you know what? I'm not here to make money. I'm here to make friends. How pathetic. And who wants to be a friend of somebody like Johnny Barber or these gamblers here? So I thought, you know, if I'm going to do this, I better learn to do it right. So I went to the library, which was right across from the police station, and I got two books called Scarny and Dice and Scarny on Cards. And I don't have a photographic memory, but for some reason, every book I read stays in my head. And I became an expert. I realized I didn't have to be in every poker hand. And in about 10 weeks, I won $700. You know how much that is in 1970. And so what I did is I went out and bought a blue suit. When you see the cover of my book, you'll see me wearing that blue suit in front of the Flamingo Hotel. But I'm wearing a Stetson because I'm only 17 and I wanted to look older. You know, you wear a Stetson, all hat and no cattle. So I cross the border at Niagara Falls and I tell the immigration people I'm there for a day to look around. And I stayed 400 days until the FBI caught me and turned me over to immigration. Now I'm on my way. I get a ticket to Las Vegas, which is the Vatican. And there's an accident in northern Las Vegas. On the tracks, and it's not quite explained, but see, I've been in such trouble as a kid. I think the immigration authorities have called the railroad and said, hey, there's this illegal alien named John Barber on your train. We're coming to get him. So I hopped off, and the closest place I could get to was Lake Tahoe, which looked like a smaller version of Banff National Park. It was gorgeous, and I'm in front of the Calneva Lodge. I go inside the lodge, and it's like going into an MGM musical movie. Yeah, I'm waiting to see Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney. I am in total awe. And after looking around for a half hour, I decide to go to the crap table and risk it. But I'm very nervous that they're going to see that this kid's only 17. And I start to gamble, and I'm rolling the dice. I'm doing okay. And people start looking toward me. And then pretty soon the people at the bar are looking toward me. And then the dealers stopped dealing. And I thought, oh, God, they're going to arrest me. But I realized they're looking around past me. And I turn around, Peter, and coming through the two glass doors, one is Frank Sinatra with his overcoat draped over his shoulder like an Italian Superman. He is not beside Sam Giancana. He's literally arm in arm with Sam Giancana, the mafia godfather of Chicago. And the reason I know that, it's on the front page of the paper I left in the train. And they're surrounded by three Italian Praetorian guard. Everybody, of course, got silent because there's the young king, Frank Sinatra, walking by. A week earlier, Peter, I'd been in the Manor Theater on Kingston Road. I think the movie was called As the Clouds Roll By. It's the biographical film of Jerome Kern, who wrote the lyrics to Showboat. And at the end of the film, there's Sinatra in a white tuxedo on a white pedestal singing Old Man River. Oh, my God, it was beautiful. Now he just walked out of there and is walking by me. And a little over 20 years later, I accidentally became his private writer.
Wow. You know, one of the things that proves how good your book is the fact that you are a master storyteller. And I think that's one of the reasons why Real People was such a hit on NBC for 5 years when it was on, starting from 1979 to 1984. I could speak to you all day, but unfortunately, we're basically out of time here. So,
Peter, honest to God, I love talking to people like you who are really interested in stories, who are really interested in the media. And I just loved it. And I hope I get a chance to talk to every once in a while.
I know you said that you don't think a show like Real People could be on TV today, but I'm going to beg to differ that certain things can have a revival if it finds the right place. And I think a show like Real People, a new version of it, is something that could be streamed, something that might even be on Netflix, you know, with maybe...
You know what? Yeah, you're right, and you're very perceptive, but I'm going to tell you something. It is the storyteller, often more so than, I hate to say this because it sounds like I'm blowing my horn. When I wanted to do the Adam Walsh story, George Slaughter, who is the owner of Real People, George Slaughter was the Jerry Jones of television. He owned the stadium, but he didn't know how to play the game. I was the coach, and I was literally the team, even though I had great co-hosts like Sarah Purcell and Skip Stevenson, because when he said, I don't want that story, it's so negative on the, and he said, everybody knows the story. And I said, have you ever heard of the Jumping Frog of Calaveras County? And he said, yes, everybody knows. That's Mark Twain's story, made him a hit. I said, that's right, but how many times do you think they had the Jumping Frog contest at Calaveras County? They had it every year. It was in the paper every year until Mark Twain told the story. And that was the thing that made Mark Twain a star. Do you know that Hamlet has been written 11 times before Shakespeare wrote it? So it's not often the story, it's often the storyteller. And I was the storyteller.
And you are indeed the storyteller. I got to mention your book here because we're running out of time. The book is Your Mother's Not a Virgin, The Bumpy Life and Times of the Canadian Dropout Who Changed the Face of American TV. We should also mention your website, which is johnbarbersworld.com. And Barber is B-A-R-B-O-U-R, johnbarbersworld.com. John, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Oh, listen, Peter, you send me your address and I'll messenger you an autographed copy of the book. And I can't thank you enough for having me on. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
John Barber, the godfather of reality TV and the author of Your Mother's Not a Virgin, The Bumpy Life and Times of a Canadian Dropout Who Changed the Face of American TV. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0529, and you'll find links to John's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. I've also put in a link to a YouTube video that you can check out that helps to promote his book. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, coming to you from Montreal, Canada, where we share the longest unprotected border in the world with the United States. Take that as a sign of extreme friendship or a warning.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to the author of A Single Light. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way. And I've got one more Stuff File news story that I want to share with you right here, right now, on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. And we're also heard on Spotify. At New Lynn's Peaches and Cream, a sex toy shop in suburban Auckland, New Zealand, staffer Kat Marr immediately noticed a strange customer on September 23rd. He was very energetic and erratic, going around the shop, talking a lot, she said. Strangely, he also closely resembled Elvis Presley, with slick back, black hair, and sunglasses, although he was wearing a high-visibility orange vest. He brought a sex toy called Like a Virgin up to the counter, but his card was declined, Marr said. When the purchase didn't go through, the man grabbed the fake vagina toy, worth about $60, and ran out of the store.
All right, Elvis has left the building. I've told you absolutely straight up to this point, you know that he has left the building. He left the stage and went out the back with the policeman, and he is now gone from the building.
Actually, Marr reported the theft to police, but fake Elvis has not been apprehended. She also noted that the shop gets robbed about once a week. It's really frustrating when this sort of thing happens, she says. So rude, and it ruins your day. Yes, Elvis has left the building with a hunka burning love. Anyway, let's get to our last guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Tosca Lee is an award-winning New York Times best-selling author of 11 novels. Her latest is A Single Light. It's the sequel to her critically acclaimed dystopian thriller, The Line Between. Tosca joins us on the line via Skype from Lincoln, Nebraska. Hi, Tosca.
Hi, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I have to ask someone who writes a dystopian thriller right off the bat, are you generally an optimistic or pessimistic person?
Believe it or not, I'm an optimist.
So tell us about the story, first of all, for those who may not have read your first novel, and how it dovetails into the sequel.
Sure, absolutely. Well, the first book is called The Line Between, and it's the story of a young woman named Winter Roth. She's 22, and at the start of the book, she is getting ousted from a doomsday cult on the American prairie in Iowa. And so she is now having to learn to start over in a secular world that she's been taught to regard as evil. And at the same time, previous to this, a few months back, a disease has come out of the melting Alaskan permafrost. And so that disease has wound its way down the Pacific Northwest and has begun to spread across the continental U.S. And so as it picks up in speed and becomes a full-blown pandemic, it begins to look a lot like the apocalypse that winter has always been taught was coming. So it turns into a survival story, and it turns into a kind of a critical coming of age. And through a series of events, Winter comes into possession of a set of medical samples that may be tied to the disease. And she is now tasked with getting them through Nebraska, where I live, into Colorado to a lab there. But during this time, an opportunistic cyber attack has happened and taken down the U.S. electrical grid. So things have just gone from bad to worse. And so that book is all its own adventure. It ends, and we think that Winter's in a safe place, and a single light picks up exactly where the first book ends, and things are not so safe after all.
Now, so there is a medical component to this, as you mentioned. You're not a medical doctor, and I bring that point up because there have been in the past people who have written about pandemics who did have a medical background. Michael Crichton comes to mind. Dan Calla comes to mind. Without having a medical background, is it a little more difficult to be research heavy in your case before you can start writing a book like this?
No, and I'll tell you why. My sister is a physician and she teaches medical school, so I have this built-in advantage. And actually, she's the first person I went to. I said, you know, I need a disease. I need it to be something that, you know, may not be what we have now, but it could realistically recombine and become more contagious. And so she's the one who suggested a prion disease. And as I learned more about them, I learned that they are really, really frightening. Prion diseases are what caused, caused diseases like mad cow, which most of us have heard of. But there's also a human variant too. And in this case, it's an ancient prion that we have not experienced, and it recombines with the flu, and so it becomes very contagious. So, yeah, so it's not a real disease, but it's based on real disease stuff.
When you wrote the first one, The Line Between, did you envision that there would be a sequel to it? Did you feel that story was done? Or did you have an aha moment later, not only with the success of your book, but just with writing the story, that you thought maybe there's more, and that's why A Single Light is here?
No, I knew that it would be two, and I knew it would be just the two for now. So I had two books left in my contract, and we were trying to decide what I would write next. I went to New York, I met with my publisher. They loved this idea. And so we dedicated these two book slots to The Line Between and A Single Light. That said, if there was a huge, you know, demand for more in the future, I mean, they are in development for television. So if that were to happen and there was a great amount of interest, I could probably be strong-armed into writing another. But for now, it's just the two.
And we should mention that the first book, is just out in paperback as well, right?
Yes, it is. It just came out in paperback, and the second book came out just on the 17th of September. In hardcover and ebook.
Okay. Now, when you're writing, I'm just curious about your writing style or system. When you're writing a story like this, especially one that requires, as we've already discussed, a certain amount of research, do you know where your story and your characters are going all the way through, or is there some point of discovery for you as you write?
That's a good question. And, you know, there's all different ways that authors do this. There's the pantsers who write by the seat of their pants, and then there's the plotters. I'm kind of in between. I have to plot a certain amount of the story, and I have to kind of know what's happening at the various turning points in the story. I don't know all the details. And so as I'm writing, things do happen or come up, or, oh my gosh, wouldn't it be cool if this or that? So I do leave room for some mystery. But I do have to kind of know where it's going. I may not know exactly how it ends. And when I do have a sequel, I don't plot the sequel when I plot the first book. I leave myself hanging and then go into the second book with, oh my gosh, how am I going to write my way out of this one? So
People who actually know you, your friends and family, do they recognize you in any of the characters? Or for that matter, do they recognize your sister? Because maybe she's one of the characters.
You know, I don't think so. I know I've heard, and I'm sure this happens with other authors, but I've heard people say that they hear my voice because I write in first person. And so I've heard people say that, you know, I hear your voice when, you know, when the character is speaking, but I don't know if they see me as much. I did give Winter, my main character in The Line Between in A Single Light, I did give her obsessive compulsive disorder, which I have. But other than that, no, she's 22 and, you know, she's got her own thing. So I don't think they would very much.
Now, I understand you have, was it four children?
Yes, four stepchildren, yes. I married a single father and so became instantly a mom.
And so I'm just curious to know when what it's like for your kids to read what you've written. Because, you know, they live with this person. They know what this person's like. And here is someone in their house writing a dystopian thriller.
Yeah, you know, the ones that we've got at home, I've got one out of the house on her own and another one just started college. And the twins that we have right now, they're more into video games than reading. So they actually don't read a lot of my stuff. It's not really that cool to them. I mean, I don't think they think that much about it. My stepdaughter, who is 24, who Winter is named after, her name is Winter, she does read my stuff. And I think she enjoys it, but I mean, it's just normal for them.
Well, you say that the twins are into video games and maybe not into your books, but
yeah.
you also mentioned that your book has been optioned to be filmed. So that's probably big news for the kids.
I'd probably be much cooler if that happened. Yeah, I'd probably be a little cooler. So let's hope it happens.
Do you have yourself any ideas or thoughts about how it should be filmed and who it should star? Who would play your character in your estimation if you were casting it right now?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I'm not one of those writers who actually pictures certain actors or actresses when I'm writing characters. And ultimately, it's not something I would have any say into. So as they continue down that development journey, there's so many hoops to jump through. So I'm always just happy and cheering as they cross each one. But when they get to the point where they can pick out a casting director and that person can get to work, I will be so excited to see. But, you know, I would love to see like a young kind of unknown actor play the main role in this TV series, you know, because then you don't think of other movies or shows when you see that person. You know what I mean?
Yeah. As a writer, it's a very solitary profession that you do give up a little bit of control, perhaps with the editing process. But by and large, it's you and you alone. Do you feel it'd be a difficult transition to literally give up control of your characters for a cinematic version of your stories?
No, not too much. I mean, I get asked this quite a lot, and I know that it's difficult for some authors. And, you know, there is always the chance that it could be made into a bad show or a bad movie, and that's kind of the chance you take. But our production team of Radar Pictures and Ed Burns's production company, they are so good. And our writer for this, Glenn Whitman, who wrote for The Fringe and The Strain, is so smart and on top of things. And, you know, I literally wrote to Glenn last week and I said, you know, this story is yours now. So, you know, you take it and you run with it. And of course, things change a little bit in the process because writing for TV is different than writing for books or writing for movies. And I'm excited to see what they do.
Well, and I'm sure we're all excited about the new book itself, which is called A Single Light. It's now out in hardcover. The first chapter is just out in paperback. That's The Line Between. Tosca, thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a delight.
Tosca Lee, author of A Single Light. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0529, and you'll find links to Tosca's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her books directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
A suspected cell phone thief in Washington may want to reevaluate things the next time she feels inclined to call 911 for emergency assistance. The female suspect reportedly called 911 to get in touch with the Seattle Police Department because the man she allegedly stole a cell phone from wouldn't leave her alone. When officers responded to the call at a gas station, they found the 20-year-old suspect standing with a 21-year-old man who had multiple cuts and bruises. The suspect told SPD officers that the man was napping on a Metro bus when he awoke and accused the woman and her boyfriend of taking his phone. The man corroborated that he had been on the bus, but told police he started chasing the suspect and her boyfriend after they grabbed his phone and took off. When he asked them to return the phone, the pair allegedly punched and kicked him in the head. According to the man, the boyfriend kept on going when the suspect stopped to call 911. Officers searched the woman and found the victim's phone and 3 grams of crack. They booked her into King County Jail for investigation of robbery and drug possession. Now, why, oh why, would you steal someone's phone, fight with the phone owner because clearly he wants it back, and use said phone to call 911, all the while when you have crack in your possession? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0529. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0529. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Well, you weren't literally with him. Well, maybe you were, but I don't see how. I mean, he does record these in advance, you know. Okay, maybe you did listen with him. Who am I to call you a liar? And personally, I've never met the guy, and I'm not in a hurry to either.